Hello and welcome to the Other Banana Podcast. I'm Aditya. We are returning after a long time and with a slight difference in this new episode. Joining us today are two very special guests. We have filmmaker Don Palatra, who's directed films such as Shravam with 1956, Central Tamilpur, Santosh Dinte, Onam Rahasyam, and Everything is Cinema. His new film, Family, premiered recently in the International Film Festival Rotterdam. Hi, Don. Thanks for joining.
Hi, Aditya. It's a pleasure to be here.
Along with him is Shirin Catherine, a sociologist who also dabbles in writing and acting. She co-wrote Everything is Cinema and Family with Don. Hi, Shirin.
Hi, Aditya. Thank you for having me here today. Hi.
So for what's different about this episode, we will be talking about a Swedish film and not an Indian film. We wanted to have Don and Shirin for an episode, and we asked them to choose a film, and they chose Swedish filmmaker Roy Andersson's A Pigeon Sat on a Branch Reflecting on Existence. It's the last part of Andersson's Living Trilogy with You, the Living and Songs from the Second Floor. His most recent film is, of course, 2019's About Endlessness. Andersson is a single filmmaker, and there's a lot we can cover when talking about him. So let's dive right in. I should start with Shirin, because I think this was your choice. Can you talk about why this film, when was the first time you watched it, and something on those lines?
So first of all, like, I'm not a theorist of cinema, neither am I a filmmaker, at least not yet. So I'm an anthropologist. So what appeals to me the most, or say what I can discuss about rather comfortably when it comes to movies, are the anthropological or say sociological and sometimes the philosophical details concerning them, concerning movies. So when I watch movies, what I generally look at are these aspects. So Roy Andersson's A Pigeon Sat on a Branch, Reflecting on Existence, it appealed to me for these same reasons, because the movie was sociologically rich. It offered me a lot to bite into. There were a lot of philosophical details that appealed to me. So like you have already mentioned, it's a part of his trilogy about being a human. So this movie, according to me, it manifests many aspects of being human, okay, but mostly of the absurdities and ridiculousness surrounding human existence. So this is also very evident in the many stylistic devices and the many themes that are submerged throughout the movie, which I was very happy to witness and to reflect on later. So yeah, that's why the movie was appealing to me in the first place. So before I go into the details that I want to talk about, maybe Don could, you know, chip in a bit.
Don, you did, I think I remember you did a long thread on movies that influenced you, and this was definitely on that list.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this is definitely a movie that I really like. For the cinematic style, of course. And and the thoughts that are evoked by this film. And I think this is one of his best works. When we watched his recent film, the latest film at IFFK, I felt that it was kind of a repetition of his previous style. But for this film, I think. What interested me the most when I watched for the first time was the thought that, oh, you can actually do that, this kind of, you can actually make this kind of a movie. Someone actually made this kind of a movie was really a surprise. Not just this one, any of his films other than the first one. Because of his unique style and the way he composes his images and how he uses simple cinematic techniques to talk about very philosophical ideas, Sometimes it's just a frame or like something, some slight changes in the frame. And sometimes I felt that the way he deals with absurdities through by creating his own world, it's in parallel to our world. He's creating his own world in his films, and then he makes slight errors there, like very conscious errors. For example, sometimes a misplaced person or a misplaced a misplacement of some sort. What I felt when I watched it. And sometimes it is a misplaced time, it is misplaced space. It can be anything, a misplacement of something of some sort. And then that suddenly gives this plane and image a whole new dimension. That's the first thing I would like to think about when we talk about this particular film.
Yeah, it's definitely it's very distinct, and it's very anti-narrative. There isn't a narrative device or such, and like you said, a lot of things intermingle. I think in this film you have the Charles the King Charles and coming into the modern world and things like that. Sharon, since you mentioned about sociology and anthropology, I wanted to ask you, what is the first thing that strikes you in Anderson's films, and this one in particular? Does the making distract you, or are you singularly focused on the critique that it provides?
His movies, for instance, the last one about endlessness, and even this movie, there is this aspect of watching and seeing, and a very sensory experience of watching, seeing in about endlessness. I don't remember the details of it, but then there is this person who sees things, who watches people engaged in different activities. Yeah. The same with a pigeon sat on a branch reflecting on existence. Instead of a protagonist, it's the pigeon itself sitting on a branch, watching humans and reflecting on human existence. So I like the aspect of seeing, because seeing, as I said, the ocular, the visual aspect of it is directly connected to knowing. If you read Indian philosophy and the way in which sociological ethnography in India has been done, we can see that seeing is understood as knowing. So it's a very so that aspect is something that I like about his movies, knowing through seeing, and the movie then becomes a very rich sensory experience. Another thing about this movie in particular, I liked the way in which paradoxes were used in the narrative style of this movie. we know it's a highly symbolic movie. It's an existential film, and it explores the absurdity of human existence. But this exploration happens through paradoxes, and I like it very much. The paradoxes that are presented in the film, they kind of challenge our perceptions of reality, I think. And in a way, these paradoxes also highlight the inherent contradictions and say irrationalities that exist in the human experience. For instance, there is a sea captain with seasickness, right? So he, according to me, he represents the idea of an individual who is very much ill-equipped to deal with the very thing that he's meant to be good at, the very thing that he's supposed to. This could be a simplistic reading, but readings can be, it can be polyvalent, but this is my idea. And then there is this crybaby who wants to help people to laugh, right? He could be the reflection of the paradoxical nature of human emotions. like I said, it could be a simplistic reading, but it's there. And then there is the scene where Jonathan and Sam look for a street address that does not exist, right? So this could be highlighting the search for meaning and purpose in life, which can sometimes be a very futile and a very meaningless pursuit. So all these are like, there is one more paradox. And then there is a Wednesday that feels like Thursday, right? Towards the end, the very end.
Yeah.
So this could be reflecting on the arbitrary nature of time, and all these are paradoxes. So all this communicated to me that, all these paradoxes in the film suggested that human experience is often marked by confusion, by contradiction, and maybe a search for meaning and purpose. And all this was intriguing to me. And instead of going into critiquing these aspects or just, you know, or going deep into them, I just sit and reflect on these things, like the pigeon herself. So yeah. I like to reflect on these paradoxes. I liked it very much. Yeah.
Yeah, Don, as a director, like you did talk about his distinct compositions. Is that something that strikes you first? Like you have all these only wide angle lens and master shots and soft lighting, no shadows and very painterly frames. Is that something that first strikes you, or is there more the more philosophical and sociological aspects that strikes you, or is it about how they both come together so well?
When I first watched Tati's Playtime, while I was still in my film school, these things are, you know, like really intrigued me, because he uses this static frames and wide angles and these large sets and very distinct way of creating subtle humor, and that really impressed me, and I tried to execute some of those techniques in my first feature. I don't know whether I succeeded or not, but but that was the intention anyway. So when I look at Roy Anderson, I can see a lot of Tati in his films, and how and it was very, like, you know, when I was reading on him, it was very interesting to learn that he was highly influenced by De Sica's Bicycle Thieves, which is supposed to be the pioneering film in the realistic era. And I can see where he comes from and how he has developed his signature style. But one thing I don't know, maybe this is an interpretation and this is not something in his mind as a filmmaker, but when I look at it as a third person, what I see is when he makes these static frames and and these wide angle, using this wide angle and deep focus and all, but at the same time he uses techniques such as lighting and leading lines to kind of lead our eyes to certain places, at least in the beginning. But then since he is giving us a lot of time, we get to explore throughout the frame and find our own little things that we connect with. And I like how he frames his characters like almost non-active or very passive in their body language and all. But at the same time, you know, after a while, you start traveling with them and you start feeling for them in certain ways. So I really respect that kind of respect that he gives to his audience.
Yeah, the kind of depth he uses, and also how it, like you said, it really demands our attention because something else happens on the complete corner of a frame. And so someone just walks in, or there's a mirror where you two characters are talking, and then you see the other people in the cafe or bar sitting and doing something else. That's very true about the films. Sharon, coming back to you, I wanted to ask you if you have. If you can elaborate on the opening of the film, like we see the three deaths, and there is one a man dies when he's opening a wine bottle, and there's one where this old lady wants to take her wealth to heaven, and it's almost like, you know, it seems to be a very at least appears that these people are a privileged bourgeoisie lot, and there's also this guy who dies in the diner and he's ordered a shrimp sandwich. But I don't know, this is actually a very, very weird coincidence. I saw this Alicia Vikander talk, who's from Sweden, talk about how there's a saying in Sweden that you don't just slide in on a shrimp sandwich, is a Swedish saying, which basically means that don't come here, walk in with your privilege. And it's a Roy Anderson in this film, it actually makes sure that what did he order, and they say it's a shrimp sandwich. So can you elaborate on the three deaths that begins the film?
Okay, very specific question. I don't know if I would I would focus on that that specific theme of the three deaths. But what I could say is that Roy Anderson actually uses a lot of repeated motifs like death and isolation, and a lot of repeated statements also. Throughout this movie, right? For instance, you know, there is this, there are certain statements that are repeated all the time. For instance, I'm happy to hear that you're doing fine. Yeah. What line of work are you into? You're a widow, a widow's veil was your gift. And there's another statement, you have no messages. And and there are repeated descriptions of the vampire teeth, of the laugh bags, and Uncle One Tooth. Yes, and then there are repeated motifs of isolation, of death. So I think that he emphasizes these themes and these motifs, maybe to highlight, like we have already established, maybe to highlight the absurdity and the ridiculousness and say the banality of life, right? I think that, you know, he tries to create a certain sense of monotony and repetition, which is very thought-provoking, often humorous, and often it's plain, sad also. If you ask me, this repeated motifs also shows us how people are on autopilot almost all the time in a society. You know, you perform certain social roles, and you perform, you know, you act in certain ways in which you are supposed to act, and you cannot see any subjectivity there. So in a way, you know, you talked about the bourgeoisie, and, you know, I mean, be it the bourgeoisie, be it the proletariat, there are certain roles that we are supposed to follow, or, you know, which we follow nevertheless. So these repeated motifs, these repeated themes kind of manifest these rules, or these set patterns, or this autopilot mode that we go into. There is this sociologist, Marshall Sahlins, you know, when he talks about the marinations, he actually talks about, he actually makes a distinction between two kinds of social structures, okay? So there is this prescriptive structure and performative structure. So the prescriptive structure is all about explicit rules that deals with who may do what and with whom. You know, but when it comes to the performative aspect, it's about, you know, people can actually make up the rules as they go along. But most of the time we are kind of stuck to the prescriptive structures, and this is what brings a certain sense of monotony and repetition in people's lives. So I think death is, we are also supposed to die, and we are also supposed to die in a certain way, and you know, it's a very, very prescriptive aspect of our daily mundane repetitive life. So I see it that way. I mean, these are all scattered thoughts.
Of course, yeah.
Because that's, it's fine. A very, yeah.
No, that's fine, yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's interesting, of course. Don, can you also take it forward? Like, what are your, not just this film, like any of even over the trilogy, his motives and his characters, what do they really grapple with, and what is the most appealing for you, or even what strikes you the most in terms of the characterization? And of course, there isn't much of a very conventional sort of way when you talk about films, but at the same time, what kind of people that you encounter in these films?
I also have very scattered thoughts regarding that, but I agree to most of what Sharon just said, and the themes, these are the thoughts, but I'm not I'm not that good at articulating these thoughts into words, but most of these thoughts are along the similar lines. Another thing that that is always there in his films is this pessimism. I don't know whether it's, you know, like it's a right term to use, but it's a lack of optimism, or lack of hope. Maybe, you know, hope is a better word. So a lack of this. Stupid hope that we always find in films, especially in commercialized films, that is lacking here. So yeah. He doesn't give you a definite, okay, everything is going to be a better kind of narrative towards the end. So it's always hanging in the middle. It's like almost like never ending. His films are like, you know, like I don't even find it a necessity to call his films a trilogy. It's almost like a continuation. Like he keeps on working, and it's like an extended version of his previous works, and it's still happening. That's what I feel about his works in general. And and all these themes about existence and the futility of life, but at the same time there are good moments. There are moments of reconciliation. There are moments of small hopes. There are moments of relief, and it's just a reflection of life. And like his. The whole constructed world of his, it is a reflection of our world. So, and his, you know, even though in the movie, it's a simpler version. It's not as complicated as our world. He has removed some noises here and there, so we can concentrate on certain things and see certain things more clearly. That's what I feel.
Yeah, that's actually an interesting point, because you said maybe pessimism, you're not sure if it's the right word, but I was wondering if the films in some way are, you know, cynical in nature, and there's a cynicism towards life and towards being human itself. Sharon did talk about the proletariat versus bourgeoisie, and in these films it doesn't really matter sometimes, because no matter who you are, it seems to be a challenging thing to be human. Sharon, do you think cynicism is a big part of these films, or this film in particular?
This podcast is starting to sound a lot like home. You know, because
not like?
A lot like home.
home.
Because this is how we keep on talking at home.
That's fine. That's what we
need. Don and I. Okay. So, yeah. So, I think that, yes, you know, like Don has already mentioned, you know, there is a certain, there's a certain aspect of pessimism, a lack of optimism. Like, you know, we could actually refer back to a plethora of philosophers, including Jean-Paul Sartre and all that, you know, people who talk about how, you know, talk about bad faith and, you know, do people have choice or not? So, yeah, I agree with that. But also, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's and of course, there are also moments, like he said, there are moments of reconciliation. And yeah, but mostly the color, the overwhelming backdrop is one that of pessimism and futility and you know, lack of colors. And, you know, the entire movie is gray and people are gray and, you know, lifeless also to a certain, and this lifelessness could be a reflection of lack of subjectivity because they are just, you know, pawns on a chessboard and, you know, they are, like I said, they are acting according to the prescriptive structures that they are submerged in. But another thing that struck me, if I'm allowed to talk about it. So when Don talked about his movies, like Roy Anderson's movies being continuations of his previous movies and all that, that words struck me and I wanted to talk about something in this particular movie. I don't know how to, like I said, like, I don't know how to articulate this in cinematic language. Maybe Don can do this. This is also a question to Don from my part. I noticed that when I watched this movie, there is this sense of fluidity and continuity that is that's there in this movie throughout and in various forms. For instance, frames kind of flow into each other. Like, you know, when, I don't know how to articulate it, but I think Don will get my language. What I'm trying to say is that when a person is in a room and he's doing some activity, for instance, in the beginning of the movie, a person collapses in the dining room, but at the same time, his wife is washing away the dishes in the kitchen and you can see both of them together. And the same with the mom's, the mom being sick in the hospital, like, you know, a guy enters and he goes to the changing room. He takes his cot and, you know, puts it on the hanger. At the same time, we can also see what's going on in the patient's room. Then, and then, you know, a scene where a woman and man are seen lighting a cigarette. So there is this parallel existence of frames and things that are happening. At the same time, there is also a lot of past frames flowing into the present. Like the past and present, you know, kind of fuses together when Charles the 12th enters, and also, you know, when we go back to those colonizing Britishers, you know, that dream sequence. And also the voices are also seem to cross boundaries, right? Like the songs from the past in the restaurant scene, crosses through the boundaries and reaches the contemporary time. And so there is a certain blurring of the lines between different moments and places and time periods. So so I found it very intriguing, you know, because I don't know what he wants to convey. Maybe, you know, he wanted to explore themes of existence and the fluidity of time and interconnectedness, maybe. So maybe this is what the pigeon was thinking about, you know, while sitting on the branch. So I just want Don to comment on this fluidity and you know, this blurring and liquidating of boundaries.
Actually, before I give it back to Don, the thing that you described early on about what we see the other character, we see what the other character is doing, and I think this happens in that dance class where the choreographer the dancer, the choreographer flirts with one of the dancers and he just walks out, and then we listen to the janitor on the phone talking about that's actually a very neuralist technique where, you know, you focus on the side characters and for a minute before you go back to the actual narrative. But yeah, that's a good point.
My point is that the everything is flowing like that. The voices, all kinds of sensory aspects, be it auditory, be it ocular, be it temporal, all kinds of modalities are flowing into each other. That's how I felt it. I felt that it was fluid. I don't know if it's just my personal experience, but Don could comment on it. I thought.
For me, that's just Roy Anderson being himself and his personal style or personal signature being there in every frame. And I don't think he would do it in any other way, even if he is given a chance. I think that's the film that we see. We are actually seeing the filmmaker and his signature. So that is what gives it that kind of fluidity that Sharon means, I think, probably. When we are talking about these different scenarios that he has put us in, even while the man is trying to open the wine bottle, what happens is we are seeing both these characters at the same time, and the wall between them is probably separating them. The way they are standing and the way they are positioned are separating them from seeing each other. Or her from seeing his condition, but it's not restricting the viewer from seeing both of them, and that is a particular. And it's almost like the filmmaker or the camera knows what's going to happen, so it's actually predicting what is going to happen later in the frame. So he has positioned it in certain way, almost like a prediction even if this is going to happen, you will be able to see both of them, even though they won't be able to see each other. And I think it is another shot from You the Living, I think, girl crush on the pop singer, and later she dreams that they have gotten married and they are in a room, and later slowly that we see that the room has started moving, or the room was already moving, and the outside the window we see this people coming, and they have reached a railway train station and everything. But just before that happens, Anderson pans his camera to the left, so we get a better look at the window. That's a very slight movement, very slight pan, and it is as if he is predicting everything in advance. His camera is all knowing, and it tries to include that future into the frame. It is not like camera finding something accidentally, or we are surprised by something. He doesn't like surprises. He already knows I don't know the right term for that, but he want to express it in such a subtle way, or he doesn't want to emphasize things he doesn't like underlining things. But while slowly revealing things over time, that he is again creating another analogy to life itself.
Shem, did you get a convincing answer?
No.
I'm just kidding.
While talking about fluidity and all this, I had a question. I think like, you know, Roy Anderson had been influenced by different painting styles and painters, right?
Yeah. So
does it have anything to do with the certain fluidity that we see? I mean, I was thinking, because about endlessness, towards the end, there is this beautiful, you know, there is beautiful vignette whereby we see a couple who is flying in the sky. So this is, of course, it was, of course, influenced by Chagall's painting, right? The bridal pair with the Eiffel Tower, something like that. So, you know, you see a bride and groom, you know, floating and all that. And I think the pigeon sat on a branch existing on, I mean, reflecting on existence is also influenced by some painting, right? The I mean, are you aware of it?
There's a painting. I mean, the title of the painting, right?
Of the painting.
Yeah.
I think some hundreds, something. I forgot that. So, but this about endlessness, yeah, that
the Chagall's painting. The snow,
yeah.
By Peter Bruegel. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That one. So that, and also the I mean, about endlessness. The last scene, of course, I remember because it was beautiful, and you know, we see this bride and groom embracing and floating away in the sky. So I just wanted to know, like, you know, I don't know which other filmmakers have been so influenced by paintings and painting styles and, you know, that kind of fluidity and that kind of surrealist aspects kind of influence their filmmaking as well. So I just, again, the question I wanted to float, that like these two mediums of cinema and painting, like, you know, how can this have ramifications or consequences for the filmmaker style? I mean, is there any or not? Yeah.
Yeah, I think Peter Bruegel's paintings are actually quite constantly referenced. And, I mean, not the paintings itself, but I think the more of the style, because you have these things happening in the periphery. Like you have everything is very clear and nobody is actually on the center of attention or anything of that sort. Everyone gets equal amount of space, and I forget the name, but I think there's a painting of Jesus being on the way to the crucifixion, but the scene is of the whole area, and you have a lot of things happening in the frame.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Jesus is not the center of existence.
It is the same with the bridal pair. The heavens, and there are animals. And, yeah, sorry.
Yeah, and a lot of people do talk about Edward Hopper's influence on the frames, but Edward Hopper is far more colorful to me to be in Roy Anderson's films. But though I understand that they're talking about the framing, and they're talking about how the depth of those paintings and what all are in it, and more of these cafes and bars kind of situation. But yeah, you're right about the I'm not the best person to talk to with respect to paintings. But yeah, I understand what you're saying. Don't you have anything to add on this, on the painterly paintings, painterly frames?
Yeah, Peter Bruegel's paintings, you know, definitely have a huge influence on Roy Anderson's style, because of the vast areas that this single frame that includes, and the way the people are represented, and only with the movement of the character you can get a close-up or even a medium short. So mostly they are placed at a safe distance from the camera, so you get a very objective look at things, and you get to scan the entire area. And you, as you spend more time on it, you get to explore more things. The framing and these things, the colors, I find a very there's a contrast between the colors that they both choose. Peter Bruegel loves the color red a lot, and more warm colors, while Roy Anderson mostly employs blue and cold colors.
Very pastel shades for Roy Anderson.
Yeah. And even when he uses red, it doesn't look like red. It looks, like a pastel shade of red.
Yeah. Because you brought up the painting, Sharon, I want to ask you. You see it in songs from the second floor more prominently, of course. But the symbol of Jesus itself and the crucifixion and these things keep appearing in his films. Do you make anything of it? And what do you think the concept of God in these films really represent?
Okay, I haven't really thought about it. The concept of God or maybe the lack of
In songs from the second floor, it's more like the commercial aspect of, because they try to sell those the crucified Jesus, the one, there's this guy who tries to sell them off and make money.
I mean, like I said, like I have already mentioned, there is this concept of seeing, of sometimes a detached onlooker who is seeing things and commenting on things or just observing things. And this eye could be a very theocentric eye. I'm not sure about it, but the pigeon in this movie, you know, like I said, I think that the pigeon is sitting on the branch and watching humans with a certain kind of, if not pessimism, but a certain kind of non-attachment, and is reflecting on human existence. The pigeon's eye could be the God's eye. And also in about endlessness, you know, like I said, there are these narratives about, you know, what a person saw, and a God who is not attached, a God who is objective, a God, you know, who is often pessimistic.
There's a person who loses faith in about endlessness. There's the priest who loses faith.
Also, there are in this, I don't know what you call them, aerial shots. This aerial view, endlessness. It's from above, and of course, it's like there is this bird's eye view, or say, you know, God's eye view also happens. Yeah. So, I think God is present, but also not present. And what is God after all? Like, you know, in if you go by, again, going back to sociology, if you refer to people like, say, Emil Durkheim, one of the classical sociologists, when he says that there is only one thing that is more powerful than an individual, and that is society. And there is only one thing that the individual fears, because it's society, because the society can punish him, can ostracize him, can annihilate him. So when religion is nothing but a reflection of society, and when you actually go in front of a God, when you actually fall on your knees in front of a God, you're actually kneeling in front of society, because society is bigger than the sum total of its parts, bigger than individuals. So in all of his movies, you see this overarching presence of society and its prescriptive rules, right? We all are stuck to rules, and then our existence is really small. And you know, like, so this cynical aspects of it would be coming from the fact that the society is asserting certain kind of power over us. So God is society, according to me. Society is God. So this bird's eye view, this unattached, society who can kill you, who can mock you, who can just be very, very humorous about, you know, people dying and people messing up their lives, being isolated, being hit by cyclists. I mean, everything. So I think, yeah, there is this presence of society, God. I don't know, very scattered, but yeah.
Having just... family come out, and or do you have any thoughts on this symbolism in this film?
I'm not sure, quite sure about symbols, because every time you talk about symbols, we would be tempted to interpret, and every time we interpret it, you know, like it's we who are interpreting, and you know, like it's we are moving away from the movie itself. So, and it will be very, it will get just personal, and it will be just a subjective experience of the film. And these days, I really don't try to watch films that way. I don't try to find meaning behind images. I rather just keep looking at the images and try to analyze them more than try to get a meaning behind it. And for me, you know, I think Roy Anderson is a much, and from the kind of background he's coming from and the kind of society he's living in, I don't think he would be bound by this, the conflicts of religion and individuals. He would be a much more liberated person. He could be. Yeah, we don't know for sure. But, that's those are my thoughts.
Hello. I think I also agree with what Don just said, because even in academics, even in sociology and so on, looking at symbols as the basic building blocks of ritual or of social practices, that's going away now, because we focus more on a sensory understanding of things. Even I think that too much of a symbolic analysis is just not involved, just not interesting anymore. Just agree. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, no problem. But is it, can you expand on, but it does feature repeatedly, because that's an interesting point that Don raised about where Roy Anderson comes from and the Swedish film, and where you are from does depend, impact how your film is made and what your films are. So in that respect, what do you think? I understand that these films are very universal, and that's why even we get we enjoy them, and we also find rewarding things in them, but at the same time, and also identify with them, because it's basically about being human. But at the same time, the way they are made and over the people that they are, like you said, it also that this film in particular in the trilogy does talk about Europe's colonial past, and you have these shots inserted in the film. So in that regard, how do you see that? Where this film is coming from, and how that would have influenced how it got made, or its narrative structure and the people that it populates.
This is a question to me. I think that a work of art or a piece of writing, it has both. It will have universal meanings. It will have the structures that are universal. There could be meanings and theoretical consequences which are universal. But at the same time, work of art is also it's also influenced by the creator's personal afflictions, the political political views, childhood, and his lacks and his lacks at the same time, his or her lacks, his or her sensibilities, everything, which is a given. It's art is never pure in terms of its objectivity. It always comes, it's always an admixture. So I think that goes for everyone. When it comes to me and Dawn, when I write, I write short stories, I write poems, the biblical imagery is always there, because I was brought up in a Catholic household, and it goes very well with it. I think it applies to Don also, though he doesn't practice and all that, but in our deep-seated memory and imageries, the Christian influence is of course there, and so which goes for everyone, right? If that's what
that's true. That's of course true. I mean that's definitely even though how you grew up and how in which environment you grew up, this is going to influence even subconsciously what you create. Talking of more on the film itself, Don, can you talk about the kind of locations that these films inhabit? Actually, it's very similar across his films, right? Like you have homes, you have offices, you have cafes and bars, and this is sort of a very it's limited, but it almost encapsulates everything that you need probably to look at a particular kind of human existence. And is that something that that is noticeable? It is that something that it's a constant presence throughout his films. Like you have these very similar looking locations and very similar similarly populated frames and places in the films.
Yeah, that's probably one of the reasons we feel that there is a continuation in his films. It's probably one of the reasons. And other than these interiors of houses and rooms and lodges and these bars, we usually sometimes the railway track, the side of a railway track was there. Then for every particular scene or a particular segment, he chooses this location so wisely and in order to give away, like I said earlier, this prediction is there even while choosing the location itself, to predict the end of that that particular segment. So one of the characters are about to go away, or when you see doors, for sure they may, there's a huge possibility that they may get opened and closed. That kind of use of location is there, I feel.
I would like to add something.
Yeah.
I think that I think Roy Anderson, at least in movies such as A Pigeon and About Endlessness, he is actually a filmmaker of the everyday. He is dealing with everyday life, everyday people, and everyday isolation and death and people's happiness and lack of it and so on. So when you focus on those phenomenological experiences, and if you're going to establish the banality and the frutility and the monotony of everyday life, you have to also choose locations which can be associated with routine, which can be associated with monotony, so cafes, homes, motels, these cheap flop houses in which these people stay, offices, they all, for me, it's a very very simple choice to make, because you are establishing the monotony and monotony of everyday life and the absurdity that is derivative of it. Just a thought.
Can I have you expand on the on one of the scenes, basically you talked about absurdity. So in that regard, you have this cafe, and you have the king's guards walk in, and then the king walk in, and then they ask all the women to leave. Can you give me a very off the head sort of thoughts on what exactly you would make of a scene like that?
Oh, like I said, it's polyvalent. It could be multiple meanings, but
of course.
Like I said, the banality of everyday existence, in the sense there is this group of testosterone infused men who are going to war, and their heads high up, and they think that there is no tomorrow, and they're very sure that they can kill the Russians, and they're going. And then in another scene, we see them coming back, right? All beaten, and there is no.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I mean by the irrationality and the ridiculousness of life is, because one moment it's all honey and roses, the other moment you're beaten and you're literally crawling on the ground. So not that particular scene in particular, but then if you attach it with the forthcoming scene where they come back from the war. That's what it is, right? Everything, I mean, birth and death, success and destruction. So yeah. And it's set in the cafe because it's a very important spatial, you know, a very important space which is attached to monotony and this vicious cycle of life and lack of life and all that. Yeah.
Don, I'll first go to Don. Is there any particular scene or particular there is no narrative here, of course, but is there anything particular about this film that you like the most? Don, can you go for something that strikes you the most when you think of this film?
Yes, there is one particular scene that was quite exceptional to his own style that I found, which was different from the other segments. Usually you see only one frame, and in the dream sequence, he turns the camera around and puts it the other way. And you see all these, rich people, well, properly dressed and holding their wines in their hands, coming out and witnessing this. So, yeah, that's, that was quite surprising for the first time. And that was quite different from other shorts. And that's probably, it probably has to do with the nature of that short itself, because it's supposed to be a dream. Like other shorts, it doesn't claim to be real. And that particular scene has a little, slightly more warmer tone to all the other shorts in the film too.
Taryn, you chose this film, a pigeon sitting on a branch reflecting on existence. But of course, it makes for a trilogy with You, the Living, and Songs from the Second Floor. Like we talked about, like Don also said, that there is a certain continuity in his films in terms of both themes and of course they all deal with existence and the nature of being human. So you did pick this film out of the trilogy. I like this film a lot, but on the whole, how do you make it? Yeah.
No. This film, I picked this film, and it was purely because of personal reasons, because this is, it was for a purely personal reason, because this was one of the movies that we watched together, I and Don. And I think this was the first film of Roy Anderson's that we watched together. And that's why it's a purely personal reason why I chose this one. So I think I like About Endlessness better in terms of, I consider movies as a sensory experience, and it was an absolute movie of sensory rapture for me, About Endlessness. But this was chosen for this reason. And if it has to be like I already agree with Don when he says that this movie is, every movie is a continuation of the other, because of the stylistic choices that he has made and the way in which a series of vignettes are used, exploring different aspects of human existence and behavior. And all the three movies have got very surreal and very bizarre situations, the way in which the characters are presented as disinterested, as monotonous and all that. So there is a human tendency, that's what I think, because these movies are about human existence. I think there is this human tendency to hold on to routines and rituals for survival, and for various reasons, even when circumstances are changing. So this is very much explored in all of these movies, and that appeals to me. And of course, the way in which humor is used, it's very absurdist, deadpan humor, which is used in all these movies, and the use of paradoxes and all that. So it's very similar. It runs throughout all these three movies, and all these three movies are great. And of course, About Endlessness is a movie that I love, but this was chosen for a personal reason, because it's it's not always the movie, right? It's also about, like we have already mentioned, it's about
your experience,
personal experience and stories in the backdrop. He Don introduced me to Roy Anderson, and this was the movie that we watched today. So it's that, and then I have come to like him a lot. So
Last question: is there something that you thought we'd talk about, or you wanted to talk about with respect to this film that we missed? Anything like that for both of you?
I don't think we have missed anything, but I think, you know, while we are describing him a lot in the themes and all these, you know, philosophical ideas that he explores, we forgot to see the humor, the very subtle humor in it. We may have so and that's very important in his films. And you know, that's the only, you know, replacement for this, you know, this meaningless hope also in life. That's probably the only way we can deal with this, you know, like the horrible life that we all share. I think that's the way, that's his idea, or that's how he's that's the idea that he's sharing with us.
That's like, you know, when I explained about these three movies, I was also referring to humor, and yeah, this is what I meant. And in this movie, like you also asked me, you know, are there any scenes that I want to go back because it appealed to me. So in terms of humor, you know there are different times when women scream in this movie, right? Like the old mother, when the son tries to take away the bag from her hand, she screams. And when this king, Charles the 12th, when he tries to when he says that this is not a place for women, all women get out of this cafe, I mean, then the women scream, right? So the way they scream, it kind of elicits a laugh on our faces, right? We laugh when this. So also these are fault lines, according to me. This screams, no, women's screams are kind of they are ruptures to this monotonous. I identify myself as a sensory anthropologist. When we talk about the auditory sense, the screams, the voice is in a way used as ruptures in this very monotonous, absolutely ridiculous human existence. They're screaming, and and women who are supposed to be constrained, constrain their physical selves, constrain their voice, they're actually screaming. That rupture itself elicits humor, and it's very layered and very convoluted. But I agree with that.
One more thing I would like to mention while we are here, that, you know, I thought that that song was very, you know, interesting. While, you know, the bartender, the soldiers. The soldiers, they were singing it first, and then the same tune is repeated while the king and his soldiers are marching. They repeat the same tune, and only the lyrics are changed. So you are, you know, over time he is playing, he is reminding us of something that happened earlier, and with the use of this particular tune, and but they are quite different. And these soldiers, even though they act almost like robots, they are, there is something very very human in them. And and that is reminded again in the next shot when they return. At that time, they don't scream out, they don't order the women to go out or anything. The women are happily sitting there. Actually, and there is a contradiction in their behavior also. It is the same people who ask them to get out, But this time, when the soldiers lose the battle, these same women are crying.
Yeah.
And yeah, I found that very, very funny, very interesting. Yeah.
Like Shen said, I think, his films are a visual, oral, and ocular experience. Yeah. I think so. I think we have discussed pretty much everything I think we wanted to. Thank you, Don, and thank you, Sharon, for joining us and making time for this.
Thank you, Aditya.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for this opportunity to talk about this, and you know, and it was it was very insightful. You know, there are several things that you know that occurred to me during this conversation also, from what I heard from both of you. Thank you.
Yeah, same goes with me. Thank you. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Aditya.
Thank you, Sharon.
Hey folks, this is Deepak, aka Complicatua on Twitter, and I wanted to personally thank you for listening to our latest episode. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to The Other Banana on Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, or any of the other platforms where you listen to podcasts. Please do leave us a review and a rating, as it helps us drive visibility for our work. You can also view the team's writing or provide us feedback on our content at tobpod.com. We look forward to hearing from our listeners soon. Thank you.